Welcome to Transatlantic Rift. My name is Tom Arms, and I've been reporting foreign affairs for well over 40 years now. Each week, I catch up with my friend Lockwood Phillips on his radio show. Our friendship goes back, half a century. We used to run the dining room at school together in our final year. We're now separated by an ocean and very different political views. Once again, the big news story is Donald Trump. This time, it's the problems he's having with his health care bill. Lockwood wanted to know whether it was being reported over here in England. I said, yes, you better believe it. It's being reported big time. The reason is because it shows that he really can't do his job, even though he has a majority in the Congress. Stay tuned.
Tom, good afternoon to you.
Good evening to you, Lockwood.
And as we say, evening here, my first question is, have you all in the United Kingdom learned how to save daylight yet?
We have. We're saving it now as I speak. It means that we have an extra hour of sunshine in the evening. It's very nice, actually, except for one thing. It means also I have to spend more time, hard work in the garden.
Oh, well, the other aspect of it is you lose it, but you don't have that extra hour of sunlight in the morning. It's just a matter of shift from morning to evening. But okay, I find daylight savings a little bit of a...
I don't worry about milking the cows myself.
Oh, okay, good. Well, do they have cows in London?
Oh, yes, they do, okay. Actually. There's a city farm not far away.
Okay. Tom, let's go to some items here. I want to start with one related to the U.S. and... of course, the big story last week, first of this week, the failure on Obamacare, the effort on the part of the Trump administration and the Republicans in Washington, D.C. And of course, there's a lot of discussion and comparisons to European health care. And we're not going to get into that particular item. But I'm just curious, was that heavily covered in the press there in the United Kingdom and around the world?
Yes, the two items were covered, Obamacare and his directive on climate change.
Okay.
Two things were covered ad nauseum.
Oh, really? Okay, yes. Let's start with the issue of the climate change issue is another topic in some regards, and I'll share my observations on that in a moment. The issue of national health care, the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, whatever you want to call it. How was that played? Was that played as just confusion in the Republican Party? Was it in the U.S. or was it played as maybe a failure on the part of the Trump administration?
Both.
Wow.
And really, Trump had basically portrayed himself as the master of the deal.
Mm-hmm.
And it has really weakened his position overseas because here's a man who says he's the master of the deal, but he can't strike a deal. When he has control of both houses of Congress and he can't strike a deal within his own country, how is he going to strike a deal with other countries?
I think
that's the question which is being asked.
That's a very interesting, and I commend you on that observation because that's what we're interested in hearing. And I do want to mention while we're talking to Tom Arms, while we have the audience possibly rebelling against what he just said, I think it's important that it's perception. And Tom, you bring up a very interesting point on that perception issue. Let's talk about the rollback that was initiated yesterday through legislation, executive order, on environmental issues, the EPA. Again, how is that appearing in the foreign press? And I want to go a little deeper. What is the feeling about this insofar as the role of the U.S. in the age-old topic, climate change?
Well, it's linked to Obamacare and in the way I said, in that, it's another example of, the difficulty in dealing with Donald Trump. And the U.S. took the lead in the Paris Climate Change Convention. And they were very proud of that. Obama was very proud of it. And everyone was very happy for the U.S. to take the lead because it is 25% of the GDP of the world. And on top of that, it is the world's only superpower. Mm. So it was important to have them on board. But having said that, they are going to go forging ahead
with or without the United States. They're absolutely determined. And the EU is determined that they are going to take the lead on climate change and try and work closely with the Chinese and the Indians. And, you know, if the U.S. wants to come along in a later stage when they've managed to get rid of Donald Trump, then they're more than welcome to join them.
You know, that's an interesting observation related to China, considering one of the highest polluters in the world, if not the highest polluter in the world. I'm wondering if there's a real sense that China is going to alter its modus operandi.
It is saying it will. And I mean, it does have more coal-fired power stations than any others, but it is scrapping in the coming year just 145 of them. So it is very conscious of the need to clean up its act, literally. I mean, they've got terrible pollution in Beijing, and people are protesting against it. Mm-hmm. And the Communist Party, really, it's almost a benevolent dictatorship. And as we know, the problem with benevolent dictatorships is they don't remain benevolent. It is very responsive to the public mood, and the public mood is very anti-pollution.
And by the way, it's very uncomfortable, particularly in some of these major cities. All right, the other aspect of this in relationship to the 25% GDP and the role of the U.S. in this case of climate change is the fact that the U.S. has continued to reduce the amount of carbon that it has produced and, in fact, has been very concerned about losing that 25% of the GDP. If the U.S. continues at the current pace, there's a fear that the U.S. may not be as lucrative and also may not maintain its status as a superpower, as you described a few moments ago. Is there a realization of that or an understanding in Europe, or do they just feel that the U.S. needs to somehow continue to degrade its financial strength?
No, because don't forget they're going to be degrading their financial strength at the same time. And also, it's a question of putting, quite literally, profits before lives. I mean, the American Center, the National Center for Disease Control and Prevention, attributed 383,563 deaths in 2015 to air pollution in the U.S. There are 20 million asthma sufferers in the U.S.,
I know the
U.S. is not alone.
But wait a second.
You know, it's even worse in China. And there are problems here in London. We have air pollution problems here. There are air pollution problems in every major city. But, you know, it's a recognition that there is a problem, that something has to be done about it.
That is
what they're concerned, that the U.S. is not recognizing it. They're saying it's more important for Mobil Exxon to turn a profit than it is to save lives.
Well, no, I'm going to have to disagree with you, and then we've got to move on to other items.
Excellent.
Thank you very much. You know, the direct relationship, cause and effect here. Number one, if in fact the U.S. has continued to reduce its carbon footprint and carbon usage and improve the economy, which it has done very, very empirically, it's been proven. And the fact that you've got situations of certain health needs, I have to wonder if there might be other causes. But the fact that you're mentioning the CDC has attributed this directly to pollution in the United States, I'd have to challenge that. But I'm not a scientist. I don't want to go there. I would also argue that, in fact, many instances of people, because of the transient nature of the world, are we not bringing in people with certain diseases or proclivities that become most apparent when they come to the U.S. I have to say that some of the statistics are uncomfortable. I don't know how we came to those.
I will accept that, as my father used to say, there are lies, damn lies, and statistics.
Statistics, yes.
and both sides of any argument can usually find statistics to support their conclusion.
Right.
But I think it's beyond doubt that, you know, bad air pollution does exacerbate things like asthma and contribute to things like tuberculosis and bronchitis and emphysema.
It does. But I have to say that we've proven in this country that we've actually improved the environment. And I just don't think that
to the people of Flint.
Well, that was an issue of a failure on the part of an administration. The pollution.
It doesn't matter.
Well,
it was a failure. It was environmental failure, which meant they lost the use of their water.
Right. Well,
now, I know it's cleaned up now,
Well, not
doing one a repetition of the river catching fire at Cleveland.
That is history. We're looking in the rearview mirror, but we're looking forward, and things are improving, not only in this country, but in other countries around the world. All right, we'll take a break on that one. Coming back in just a moment with Tom Arms of Look Ahead Radio and, of course, lookaheadnews.com, which you can also become a member of, lookaheadnews.com, and go to the website to see that. You're listening to Viewpoints Around the World.
Look Ahead Radio will return in just a moment.
This is Tom Arms with LookAhead.News.com's expanded world analysis for the week being the 3rd of April. Look Ahead broadcasts tomorrow's news today so that you can plan to participate. British and EU negotiators go into hyperdrive next week following Mrs. May's formal triggering of Article 50. The next big date is 29 April when EU heads of government gather to finalize the European bargaining position. In America, Donald Trump has serious bridge-building to do with Chinese President Xi Jinping, who meets the president for the first time on Thursday and Friday at Trump's Florida Golf Resort. The two leaders will discuss North Korea, the South China Sea, trade disputes, and climate change. On Monday, President Trump plays host at the White House to Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi. The two men will discuss fighting Middle East terrorism. The battle to put Neil Gorsuch on the Supreme Court bench reaches its climax on Friday when the full Senate votes on his nomination. Democratic senators are backing the use of the filibuster to block the confirmation vote. EU foreign ministers meet in Brussels on Monday when the focus of the discussions will be the Middle East, especially Syria, Yemen, and Libya. Also at the meeting will be the Secretary General of the Arab League, Ahmed Abu Ghatif, fresh from the Arab League summit. EU and Mexican officials will also hold trade talks on Monday. The Europeans see an opportunity to increase trade with Mexico in the wake of fraught U.S.-Mexican relations. On the terrorist front, after decades of fighting, the Basque separatist group ETA is on Saturday due to hand over the last of its weapons. In Denmark on Friday, an extreme right-wing teenage girl goes on trial on terrorism charges. The 16-year-old is said to have made her own bombs and was planning to blow up two schools, including a private Jewish school in Copenhagen. The sex and bribery trial of former Italian Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi starts on Wednesday. Berlusconi has already been found guilty of tax fraud. The latest court case involves bribery, defamation, and child prostitution. Several strikes are planned next week, including a rail strike in Britain and a bus strike in the Czech Republic. A general strike is threatened in Argentina to protest against government economic policies. On the election front, there are parliamentary elections in Gambia on Thursday, and in the Georgian region of South Ossetia on Sunday, there will be presidential elections and a referendum to change the region's name to the state of Alania. The United States and EU have condemned the referendum as illegitimate. And that was next week's News Today, so that you can plan to participate in the world around you. Stay tuned for Viewpoints Around the World with myself and Lockwood Phillips.
Welcome back to Look Ahead Radio. Here is Lockwood Phillips.
Viewpoints on the talk station FM 107 AM 1240. This is Viewpoints Around the World. And I just want to make mention of the fact that the broadcast you're hearing today is a podcast and heard in radio stations around the world. And thank you very much, Tom, for your time this afternoon. I want to move on to a few other items before we get into, well, the intrigues in politics in Europe and around other areas around the world. We've got about 900 U.S. troops arriving in Poland this weekend. And things have been a little testy there on the Russian front. I'll use that description. What is the impact of this? And is there some concerns? And also, let's talk about NATO in all of this.
Well, yes, there are concerns. The 900 troops are part of a detachment of 4,000 total. Mm-hmm. And it's the last section of that 4,000. Each section is going to be out there for, I think, 6 to 9 months, and they're going to be rotated back to the States. It's a reaction from the Obama administration. I stress the Obama administration. It's a reaction to the Obama administration's decision that Poland and the Baltic states are under threat from Russia. They're under threat on a number of fronts. One, that Russia has been beefing up its conventional forces in its western district. Two, that it has occupied Crimea, annexed Crimea, that it has little green men, as they are called, in eastern Ukraine and is threatening Ukraine. And it has breached the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty and based INF nuclear missiles in the Western District and beefed up their missile base in Kaliningrad. And so the Obama administration basically has responded to that and delivered a fait accompli for the Trump administration. There's not much that Donald Trump could do if he had, at the last minute, said, whoa, let's pull them back. It really would be sending all sorts of messages. You know, I mean, might as well just withdraw from NATO entirely.
President Trump has also been very aggressive in his relationships with Iran and China. Is this possibly seen as an extension of those other actions? In other words, that we're seeing the U.S. that's being a little bit more, well, shall we say, a little bit more forthright in its reaction to the vagaries of international bullying.
It's being more forthright in the areas where it wants to be more forthright, but they're differing from the Europeans. The Europeans do not see Iran as a greater threat as the Trump administration does. They are worried about China in the South and East China Seas. That is a concern of theirs, but they are not directly threatened by China. They are directly threatened by Russia. So that is the reason for their focus on Russia, which I think is understandable. The question is, you know, Trump doesn't feel particularly threatened by Russia.
Well, that's because he's got NATO and he's got friendly European countries, although they may not perceive him as being friendly. He thinks of them as friendly European countries between the U.S. and Russia. And I think he also recognizes the role that NATO plays in the effort to staunch Russian encroachment. It is, though, interesting that we're back to a Cold War environment all over again. And I'm curious, is that an observation there in Europe?
Absolutely. You know, they really do think of it as Cold War version 2.
Gotcha.
Or the second run, the rerun of Cold War. And we'll come to that. I've got on the list also for discussion tonight about the political opposition. And that's one of the reasons why they are beginning to think of it as Cold War version 2.
Let's talk
about because of the domestic events in Russia as well.
Let's talk about that for a moment. We'll get to Brexit here in a few minutes, but let's go to that. The Russian opposition and the recent, well, I want to say opposition rallies that kind of apparently shocked the Russian administration. President Putin was a little undone by the reaction of a lot of young Russians. Am I correct on that?
Absolutely. And I'll tell you the reason why he's shocked is there were tens of thousands of these Russians protesting in 90 cities. Well, I think it was 88 cities. Now, what's particularly relevant here is the penalty for protesting. And this could be as part of a crowd or just one person on their own. Up to 5 years in prison or a gulag. And a fine that equals 2 years' salary. So it's tough. There is no free speech in Russia. I don't think there is.
This takes me to thinking of Turkey and the circumstances there, too. Are these two leaders?
These are people. Why are they forming alliances? Because they have common interests, common ways of doing things. They do things the same way. You know, the Americans are good at dealing with the Europeans because we're both democratic regions, democratic countries.
Right.
You know, and Arab countries get on well with other Arab countries because they're all Muslim. And that's part of being Arab, if you like. It's a big part of their social and cultural context. At the moment, Turkey, China, and Russia are getting on because they are authoritarian. And they don't like democracy.
Quick question.
And they say it. And they say democracy's failed.
Well, so has communism, but that's another story. We're going to get to...
No, but there's a difference. They're not talking about communism. They're talking about authoritarianism.
that's a clean and clear distinction, and I applaud that. Again, Tom Arms with us with LookAheadNews.com and Look Ahead Radio, of course, heard around the world, literally, not figuratively speaking, but heard around the world. Tom, I'm going to get back to other issues here in just a moment. You bring up China. We'll talk later on also about the Hong Kong election. And that's a very confusing topic for many of us. We don't understand how China has this extension, if you will, that actually operates under, well, theoretically, a different set of laws. We're going to get to that in just a moment. Do want to remind you, you are listening to Viewpoints Around the World.
Look Ahead Radio will return in just a moment. We now return to Look Ahead Radio. Here is Lockwood Phillips.
Viewpoints Around the World with Tom Arms of LookAheadNews.com and Look Ahead Radio. And by the way, Tom, joining you at LookAheadNews.com is free. Is that correct?
Yes, absolutely free. And sign up. I'll send you an email every week, newsletter. It includes a diary of what's happening next week around the world and links to the podcast and observations of an expat.
That's important, and I just want to commend our audience to doing just exactly that. LookAheadNews.com, and of course, Look Ahead Radio, and Look Ahead Radio heard around the world, radio stations all around the world. This program, as a matter of fact. Tom, let's move to an issue near and dear to your heart, and that being the United Kingdom. And we're going to chat about Brexit, but also I'm curious about the potential of secession by Scotland. But well, let's start with Brexit. We're seeing the story today that Theresa May, Prime Minister, has in fact sent that letter. Let's talk about the background on that letter, what it means, and what now kicks into play. And then also, what impact does this have on the United Kingdom's relationship with the rest of Europe?
Okay, well, first of all, she was supposed to sign the letter today.
Oh, I thought she had.
She signed it early and sent it by secret courier to Brussels, signed it a couple of hours earlier. She signed it late last night. And the reason she did that was because apparently she was frightened that Remain activists, those who want to stay in Europe, would have hijacked the letter and prevented it from going out. Of course, she would have just signed another letter.
I know.
It would have been the symbolism of trying to stop the letter.
Okay.
I
find that interesting.
She went around that by doing it a little bit early and sneaking it off overnight.
Well, here's the thing that shocks me on this one, Tom. In light of of modern technology and faxes and literally electronic signature, why even bother to go through the stress of actually signing a piece of paper and sending it by courier? But I commend
it. Because that's what it says in the treaty.
Okay.
And it's just like a business contract. You know, it will say, you know, all notices have to be delivered by hand, or they have to be delivered by post, or something like that. You can send something electronically, but it's not valid until it's delivered by hand, as stated in the contract.
Okay, that's interesting. All right, she has signed that. Now what happens?
Okay, what happens now? First of all, almost as soon as he received it, the president of the commission, Michael Tusk, issued a statement saying that he was missing you already, which, I thought that was amusing. It now has to go to all of the 27 EU leaders. And so Donald Tusk will be going through what Mrs. May has said, and he will be working out the Commission response. Now, Donald Tusk is the president of the European Commission.
Mm-hmm.
And it then has to go to each of the other 27 EU governments. And they're having a summit on April the 29th, at which they will be discussing how to respond. And they all have to agree. And you can rest assured that there's going to be a lot of to-ing and fro-ing now.
Okay, no,
you know, the Poles are going to be talking to the Czechs and so forth and so on. The British ambassadors in each of those 27 countries are going to be very, very busy indeed, horse trading away to try and win support for the British position, and the French and the Germans and so forth, they're all going to be trying to get their 2 cents in. And there's going to be a lot of horse trading going on.
Horse trading of what? I mean, the response is not much to respond to. There've been some critical remarks made about the United Kingdom. There are some issues related to trade policies. What response is needed? And what kind of things do you trade in this case?
Well, I mean, just last week I told you about the nuclear deterrent.
Okay.
That could be one of the things which goes on the table. That Britain will formally extend its nuclear deterrent, tie itself militarily more closely to the defense of Europe than it is at the moment. Although it's very closely tied now, there are ways it can be formalized and you can work with the French or whatever to make it even stronger. That would reassure the Europeans at a time when the American administration seems to be backing away from Europe.
Okay.
Now, there are lots of different things. For instance, you could do a deal whereby certain countries could get certain concessions on immigration in certain areas. You know, there's all sorts of things to be done. You know, it's just like horse trading in Congress.
I appreciate that. This is just interesting. And of course, it's a unique event in and unto itself in light of this.
It's unique in Europe. It's never been done.
It's unique, I think, in the world. I think what's being attempted and critically viewed here in this country, but I recognize the unique aspects, the risk that was taken, and the imagination that's been involved. So actually, in some regards, it's a very good thing. Or the lack there. Let's talk about one other aspect of this, and then I want to get on to the issue of the aftermath of the Westminster attack, which, of course, we were talking about last week right after it occurred. But I've teased that. Let me go first to the issue of Scotland, the potential of secession. What is the impact? What is the reality of this? What is the impact? And what about Ireland?
Well, Theresa May is very busy visiting Wales, Northern Ireland, and Scotland. She's going to all three. And she's basically, you know, trying to preach, you know, we love you. We want to keep you in the United Kingdom. The legal situation with Scotland, and she has stressed this, is that the Scottish Parliament can say we want a referendum, but it's only the Westminster Parliament, that is the Parliament in London, which can give the go-ahead to the referendum. Mm.
That is not going to go over well.
No, but it won't go over well in Scotland if they block it.
That's my point. That's
the problem.
Yeah.
There's a parallel with what's happening in Spain with Catalonia, where Barcelona is.
Mm-hmm.
And there they've had repeated referendums, even though the government refuses to allow them to have it.
Right.
And each time they get huge majorities in favor of independence.
Mm-hmm.
And it just, you know, stokes the fire of independence.
Right.
Now, I don't know what Mrs. May would do on that. She hasn't told me yet. I'm waiting to hear.
All right. Well, but the reality is there is a possibility we will have there will be an effort to push for secession. And of course, both Scotland and Ireland have a interest in staying in the EU.
Yes, okay. They do. Ireland, if you talk about Northern Ireland. Yes, but there it's divided. In Northern Ireland, between the Protestant and the Catholics, mm-hmm. like everything else in Northern Ireland.
Right.
And in Northern Ireland, they have a situation where the government collapsed because the leader of the Protestant UDF was suspected of corrupt practices, mm-hmm. shall we say.
Right. Okay.
And so the Sinn Féin Party said, we will not sit in government. It was very important that they sat together. We will not join a coalition with them until you get rid of your leader.
Right. Okay.
The UDF refuses to jettison her.
Okay.
So they've had an election. Sinn Féin has massively increased its vote and is just short of majority. And they still can't form a coalition.
Wow. All right. Well, that'll be interesting to watch in the years ahead. I want to move on to something very quickly. We've got about 2 minutes to go. I want to talk about the aftermath of the Westminster attack. What has been the fallout of that in London and quite frankly, the rest of the United Kingdom?
Well, you know, the man who, you know, was responsible for the attack was obviously a violent person and had been a violent person for many years. And for him, Islam, it's absolutely clear, Islam or jihadism was merely a conduit for his violence.
Okay.
It was a way, it was almost a way, an excuse for it.
All right. But how is this, how is this playing among the populace in Britain?
They don't see it as an Islamic attack.
They do not.
No, they do not. They see it as a man who was sick, and yes, he was exposed to jihadist literature on the internet, and converted, but he was. There's no evidence that he was in any way linked, other than through the internet, that he'd had any correspondence with people at Al Qaeda or ISIS. Now, having said that, the reaction is to blame Facebook, Google, Yahoo, Twitter, and people like that. And the Home Secretary, Amber Rudd, is saying, I want to sit down with all you people, Google and Facebook. We have got to figure out a way to get the terrorist messages off of social media.
And but wait a second. There is another social medium involved in this, and it's called Telegram, which apparently also involves, if you will, a secret message advising him and others to initiate action against civilians.
You got me on that one, Lockwood.
Okay, I'm sorry you did not know about this. We've been paying close attention. But in essence, it is part of that social media environment. Well, and it actually segues into your comment about the concerns.
He was certainly converted to jihadism. Via what he read on social media. And that, I think, it, what people here believe is the biggest problem. And that is some way we've got to heal organizations like Facebook and Google.
Right. And so
that they somehow police their own sites to keep the terrorist messages off.
Wow.
And the internet generally.
Well, that's
we've got to figure out a way to do it.
That's a big pill to swallow. I don't know how you do that. All right, we're going to get back to more here in just a moment with Tom Arms of LookAheadNews.com and Look Ahead Radio. And as he mentioned earlier in the program, tomorrow's news today at LookAheadNews.com. You're listening to Viewpoints Around the World.
Look Ahead Radio will return in just a moment.
Observations of an Expat by Tom Arms from LookAheadNews.com. She's done it. Mrs. May has gone and linked Britain's nuclear deterrent to Brexit trade negotiations. I can honestly stick out my chest, jut out my chin, and proclaim, I told you so, and I told you exclusively. All right. Mrs. May didn't actually use the N-word in her letter to the European Commission, which triggered Article 50 of the Lisbon Treaty and the start of Brexit negotiations. But in just one letter, she explicitly linked economic concessions with security issues 9 times. It requires only the smallest leaps of imagination to realize that the British Prime Minister was talking about more than exchanges of DNA databases with Continental Police. But be warned, the consequences of this link will be dire. Messing with the balance of strategic nuclear weapons capable of incinerating the world several times over is a dangerous policy. Mrs. May knows that, but the problem is that nuclear missiles are just about the only weapon the British have in their negotiating armory. Their backs are against the wall. There is, of course, a question mark over whether or not the UK will be allowed to play the security card. German Chancellor Angela Merkel has made it crystal clear that she opposes negotiations on any future relationship until the terms of the divorce are settled. That means Britain has to cough up $60 billion, allow EU citizens to remain in Britain, and accept that it will no longer be part of the European single market. All this before any talks on a future relationship which may or may not involve security. This is a direct contradiction of Mrs. May's tandem approach. Assuming that Mrs. May's simultaneous approach wins the day, what are the possible repercussions? In short, tying trade to nuclear weapons is a dangerous precedent. Offering to strengthen Britain's nuclear ties to Europe weakens the American link on which European security has been based for the past 60-plus years, and it turns Britain into a mercenary nuclear state. It is an accepted truism that if a nuclear weapon state uses its nuclear weapons, it has lost the war. The weapons are the ultimate deterrent and to be used only in that capacity. Linking the nuclear umbrella to trade concessions creates an entirely new nuclear playing field. Where does it stop? Does Britain strike a deal with Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states to protect them from Iran? The British have just reopened a permanent naval base in Bahrain. How about East Africa? The Americans leased Diego Garcia, but the British still own it. London has good relations with Singapore, an excellent base for an Asian presence. And what about other nuclear weapon states? What is to stop India, Pakistan, France, Russia, China, and the United States from using their nukes to extract trade concessions? It will cost more, but the trade deals, or should I say protection money, should more than cover the costs and make a profit. Adding a new and dangerous element to the problem of nuclear non-proliferation. A stronger nuclear Britain willing to flex its muscles fits in nicely with the Trump view of the world. During the campaign, the Donald shocked defense analysts by floating the idea that America could cut costs and commitments by supplying nuclear weapons to allies such as Japan and Saudi Arabia. It is now making more positive noises about NATO, but the initial threats still rankle at the back of the minds of European leaders. Beefing up the British nuclear deterrent and tying it close to Europe would save America money. However, it would also put several more links in the defensive chain that ties the U.S. to the protection of Europe. The Trump administration may favor such a change, but this is not in the interest of either side of the Atlantic. Two world wars have proven that. In both of them, America adopted a standoff role at the start. However, the fact that their interests were clearly intertwined with the European democracies meant that Washington was eventually forced to intervene to protect its vital national interests. If there is ever another war, the United States won't have the luxury of years to dither.
Welcome back to Look Ahead Radio. Here is Lockwood Phillips.
Viewpoints on the talk station, FM 107 AM 1240. Viewpoints around the world with Tom Arms this afternoon. And yes, this portion has been pre-recorded to accommodate a variety of meetings that both he and I are having to attend. And it's been a busy week. Tom, I've got to chat with you about two items, and we'll get into something else here of a local nature. But looking at the story about CDU winning the vote in Saarland,
Saarland.
Tell us about that. Why is this important? And who is the CDU?
Well, you know, they weren't expected to do as well as they did. And it sort of points to a victory in the federal elections in September. They were 11 percentage points ahead of second place, which was SPD.
Now,
SPD was expected to do much better because they're sort of riding on the recent appointment of a new leader. They're having a sort of honeymoon period.
But wait a second. Which country are we talking about here?
Oh, Germany.
Germany. Yes, I just wanted to get into that.
Germany.
And what impact will this have on Chancellor Merkel's election?
Well, you know, if it's indicative of the national vote, then it means that she should have an easy job being reelected when they have the elections in the autumn.
Okay.
However, I will add a caveat there, and that is that there are only 800,000 voters in Saarland out of 61.5 million nationally.
Right.
So it's a very small selection. But coming up on Look Ahead on the 7th of May is Schleswig-Holstein, with 2.3 million voters. And then on the 14th of May, there are elections in North Rhine-Westphalia with 13 million.
Okay,
so those are elections to watch very carefully.
To determine the future of Germany. That'll be interesting. All right, we've got two other items to wrap up before we close the program out. Possible trouble in Hong Kong, another election there. Carrie Lam, if you could, in about a minute, tell us about that.
Yeah, well, more of a selection than an election.
By the Chinese, by the way.
They had an election committee, which is almost entirely appointed by Beijing.
Yeah, communist Chinese.
And not surprisingly, they overwhelmingly voted to appoint Carrie Lam, who was anti-pro-democracy.
Right.
And so the pro-democracy people are a bit upset. And it's interesting to note that, in a way, they had all the trappings of an election. You know, they had debates, they had television, they had opinion polls, and she was trailing badly in all the opinion polls.
Mm-hmm.
But Beijing said, nope, we got to have our person in.
So,
and I think you could really have some problems between her and the young people who are really concerned that what's going to happen in 2047 when the transitional period ends and China then is supposed to absorb Hong Kong.
Yeah, this is going to be interesting, and it is a confusing relationship. We don't have enough time to talk about that today, but I think it's worth talking about at some point, in line to the fact that Hong Kong was originally a British protectorate. No longer.
No, a colony! A crown colony.
Crown colony. I apologize. You're correct. I apologize. But that's an important part of history. I've got two other items I want to touch on very quickly. One, I'm going to lead with first in the United States. We've been seeing a lot of stories about driverless automobiles. And I'm wondering, is there any interest in Europe, either in the possibility of driverless automobiles, or is it being covered in any way, shape, or form? Just a quick question.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. Every time a driverless automobile or car crashes, it hits the headlines here. We don't have any here.
Okay.
We like to let the stupid Yanks get on with killing themselves.
Thank you very much for testing it,
ironing out all the glitches.
Thank you very much for that.
When they're ironed out, we can have them over here.
Thank you for that compliment. But let's take one other item. We'll wrap it up with this. You'll appreciate how I segued into this. Elderly Japanese drivers receive funeral discounts if they surrender their licenses?
Absolutely. They get 15% off the cost of burial.
Well, if they're not driving, they may...
You have to be 70. Apparently, they're having a real problem with a massive rise in... because people are living longer,
right?
Obviously, that elderly people... younger people aren't living as long because they're being killed off by elderly car drivers in Japan.
I hope you appreciate the connection there. Maybe they need the driverless automobiles in Japan. And the second thing I find it interesting, it's a little morbid. We're going to facilitate your final departure if you'll just give up your driver's license. I find that...
Very Japanese.
Very Japanese. Tom Arms of LookAheadNews.com and Look Ahead Radio. Fascinating story. Tom, as always, thank you for being with us.